Thank you, Sue. Welcome to the Court of Appeals. This is Judge Sleater presiding. Judges Cochran and Kirk join me. This is the second of our five oral arguments we have today. This is the file A210313, James Johanning, Appellant versus Summit Orthopedics Limited as respondent. And counsel, you should be able to see the time clock in the corner somewhere of your screen. And so we'll be operating in the usual manner, 15 minutes for each side who wishes to argue, and then 5 minutes of rebuttal. If we lose you for any reason due to technological issues, the marshal knows to pause, and then we wait till we get you back. No recording of this proceeding is separately allowed, but the judicial branch will have a copy of the recording on the court's website within 24 hours. And so we do ask that when counsel begin that you identify your name for the record, and counsel for appellant, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court and counsel, my name is Steve Smith, and I represent Jim Johanning, the appellant in this case. Your Honors, this is a case about an employee whose job offer was rescinded because his treatment for alcohol abuse disorder was, quote, just too recent, end quote, for his employer. The district court, despite this evidence, the district court dismissed this case at summary judgment. We're here requesting a remand for trial to resolve questions of material fact that relate to witness credibility. Now, there's a few things I'd like to discuss today. I don't want to rehash the briefs, but I do think there are a few areas that are worth adding a little color to, because this case has, at least from our perspective, some sort of interesting academic legal issues relating to the Minnesota Human Rights Act, and also some complex but interesting fact questions relating to credibility. So first of all, relating to the legal standard, the Minnesota Human Rights Act has a different standard than the ADA. When it comes to proving disability, a plaintiff in an employment claim under the Minnesota Human Rights Act can prove disability discrimination by showing that you're actually disabled or that someone regarded you as disabled. When the Minnesota legislature years ago concluded that courts were being too strict on requiring what proof of disability was, and so they amended the statute. When they amended the statute, they changed the standard from substantially limited to materially limited, which was supposedly lower. Well, later the ADA is amended, and because of the U.S. Supreme Court had been interpreting that too strictly. So we have decades and decades of courts interpreting disability protections too strictly. So it brings us to today, where the district court relied on a bunch of pre-ADAA amendment cases that weren't necessarily Minnesota Human Rights Act cases to show someone was disabled. So in this case, at least what I think is maybe an interesting academic issue is this: what's the appropriate standard? Certainly material is lower than substantial. So the Human Rights Act, by nature of the amendment, is lower, but courts certainly look to state courts, certainly look to federal courts to determine what the appropriate standard is. So our view of it is that the ADA standard was lowered. The Minnesota Human Rights Act standard is certainly lower than that. Why does any of this matter? Because plaintiffs lose all the time because they're not disabled enough. They need to say that they're so messed up that they're disabled, but if they go too far down that timeline, then they're too disabled that they can't do the job. And so the ADAA amendments are instructive because they do show that if it's not a general cold, if it's something other than a cold or transitory, we should have a fight over whether they're disabled and whether it fits within a discrimination template. Can they show discrimination?
Also, I think what you're driving at is the regarded as claim. Is that correct in making this argument?
So that's the actual disability. I'm sorry, Judge, go ahead.
And so isn't really the issue that we need to address here in terms of the 2008 ADA amendments is whether that change to the regarded as claim language in the federal statute should be read into the Minnesota statute. And correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't believe the Minnesota statute has been amended in a similar manner to incorporate that 2008 ADA language regarding pertaining to the regarded as claim.
That is correct.
And that language change to the federal law was significant because it basically eliminated any requirement to show that the employer regarded the employee as being materially limited in one or more major activities.
That's correct.
So my question to you is there any case that you're aware of that has read that 2008 language into the Minnesota definition of disability, specifically the regarded as piece?
I'm not aware of a case that holds that. I do think the court is on top of the correct issue, but I think the answer to that question can still be found in the fact that the Minnesota legislature concluded they amended the disability, that the policy of the Minnesota Human Rights Act is to protect people that are disabled. Whether the court reads that into the proof scheme that applies or not here today, the evidence I think that he has shown is sufficient under either standard. I mean, he is told that his alcohol abuse is just too recent, and that's they put the pause on it immediately. And if you look at the timeline and you look at that comment, a reasonable fact finder could conclude that they regarded him as disabled, even under the current standard, which is they somehow limited him as disabled or limited in a broad class of jobs. For example, when you say, I can't bring you in to an employer, to an employment setting because your treatment is just too recent, what you're saying, and a reasonable interpretation of that statement is what you're saying is, look, we don't want you to have a relapse on our watch. Go have a relapse in some other job on somebody else's watch. And so whether the court says the ADA amendments apply in this setting or not, even under the current standard, the Minnesota Human Rights Act, a fact finder could easily conclude that they regard him as limited in a class of jobs based on that comment alone.
Well, let's talk about that a little more, and then we can turn back to the language of the definition of disability and whether that ADA standard is properly applied. What evidence, assuming it doesn't apply and we read the language as it is in the statute, the Minnesota statute, what evidence in the record is there that Mr. Johanning is materially limited in one or more major life activities that would allow you to survive, you know, that would require us to reverse the district court on the disability piece?
Well, on the actual disability piece, he has a diagnosis of alcohol abuse disorder. They don't dispute that diagnosis. He's been in treatment a few times for that diagnosis. And so our position is that in and of itself, under a liberal interpretation of the Minnesota Human Rights Act, actual disability standard is enough.
Just to clarify, Mr. Smith, on that point, is it true there's no law or case that would identify alcoholism, well, either federal or state, as a per se disability? So you would still have to meet the definitions. Wouldn't that be contrary to what you just said to us a moment ago?
We're not claiming, thank you, Judge Slater. We're not claiming that it's a per se disability. We're saying someone who's, they don't dispute the alcohol abuse diagnosis. They don't dispute that he's been in treatment multiple times. They don't dispute that probably in absence of the treatment, he could possibly have a relapse because those are all things that are personal to him, not just general to an alcoholic. So we're not saying that alcoholism is a per se disability. What I'm saying is, I think he satisfies that based on the record I just described to you.
What major life activity are you pointing to then? That wasn't clear to me in your response.
Well, caring for oneself would be one example of that.
And what evidence is there that he's not able to care for himself?
Well, so the court is required to look at the disability in sort of in its unmedicated state, so to speak. So in this case, if he doesn't seek treatment for it, he's going to have a relapse, and the things in his life that would, he's unable to take care of himself, and the things in his life that have gone off the rails have been alcohol related. So to answer sort of the judge's questions generally, whether he is actually disabled in this case is a more interesting and closer academic call. Whether there's evidence here that they regarded him as disabled is not close at all in our favor, in my view. And so reasonable minds might differ on actual disability here. When it comes to regarded as claim, the regarded as claim here, we don't think that's a close call at all. And a fact finder could easily conclude that they regarded him as disabled. Now, my
and what major life activity did they regard him as being limited in?
They regarded
what evidence in the record specifically would you point us to?
So under the Minnesota Human Rights Act, he's required to show that they regarded him as limited in a broad class of jobs. That's the requirement. And so when he's limited in the broad class of jobs, when they tell him you're going to be the inferences from the statement, your treatment is just too recent.
Doesn't that go to the qualified piece, not to the disabled piece?
Well, when it comes to perception, that's a little bit different, though. When it comes to the perception of it, it can't be that they viewed him as limited in a broad class of jobs when they say you can't perform, we don't want you here because we think you're going to have a relapse. So to require a plaintiff to show, that's why that broad class of jobs requirement appears to be in there, is that if you're going to go under the regarded as prong, you need to show how a fact finder might view you as limited in a broad class of jobs. And so here, what we have is them viewing him as limited as you're going to have a relapse. We just don't want you to do it on our watch. And that would be true whether he was working for the state of Minnesota or he's working for Target Corporation or whatever job he was in. So our view of what he needs to show for regarded as is that, not that they looked at it and said, okay, well, we view you, in the cancer setting, you know, or an HIV setting, regarded as claims that we've had before. Those are things, the evidence is sufficient for him to win if he shows that they viewed him as regarded in a class of jobs. And that certainly is the case here. I do want to, if it's okay with the court, to talk a little bit about, this leads into what the district court found in one of the main arguments of the defendant here, is this idea that there's a break in the causal chain because the real decision was made by someone else somewhere else. There's a comment in the brief that sort of talks about us being maybe a little bit jaded or craven about this idea that they're going to be lying about it. It reminds me a little bit of a court quote from, it's in our brief, but it's also the better version of it is a Ninth Circuit quote. And it talks about, it really crystallizes the challenge that an employee has an employment claim under the Minnesota Human Rights Act. And that is, the quote is this: an employer of even minimal sophistication will neither admit discriminatory animus nor leave a paper trail demonstrating it. And so the short version of that is, of course, an employer is, they're not going to come in and admit it. And so the way that discrimination is proved by circumstantial evidence or some combination of circumstantial and direct evidence. And what we know here is December 3rd, they had no issue with his application. December 4th, he informs Quigley, who is the HR director. This isn't some receptionist or low-level administrative person. He tells Quigley he needs an internal worksite monitor to support his treatment program. Her demeanor changes. She goes very cold. Plaintiff says he remembers getting chills because he knew this was not good. Quigley immediately and unilaterally puts the pause button on the hiring process by herself. She doesn't call anybody else. That's because she's their top HR person in the entire organization. The next day, she rescinds the offer of employment. And this quote is super important. And the evidence, I think the case sort of turns on this quote, at least as to whether there's facts from which a reasonable fact finder could conclude there was discrimination. Jim Johannick says, quote, is this because I was in treatment for alcoholism? Quote, are they, the organization, rescinding because of that? Quigley says, yes, quote, it's just too recent. About 10 days later, he gets a letter saying they were unable to grant privileges. That's the first time he hears that. Weeks after that, he gets a letter saying it was because of his criminal record, in particular, the DUI.
Mr. Smith, just to clarify, isn't it undisputed, though, that she was not the decision maker? And so that would be fatal to at a minimum, the direct claim of discrimination.
No, I don't think that, I disagree with that, Your Honor. She was not they're arguing that she was not the decision maker, but so let me step back and explain why that is. So this template that I described of isolating the decision maker and saying during litigation that the decision was made somewhere in Brainerd and not Minneapolis is pretty common. And so that can't break the causal chain in light of the totality of the evidence, because the court still has, and the Supreme Court in LaPointe and Kenna and Rasmussen, they say over and over again, it's the totality of the evidence that matters. And so the totality here is she's the top HR director. She gives a reason that's discriminatory. She puts the pause button on it herself. The job is rescinded almost immediately. And so my point, Judge, is a fact finder could conclude that they're not telling the truth about that, because that's how this stuff works. And credibility determinations are important. Now, they cite a couple cases. They cite a couple cases about this idea of Diaz and Clark, that statements somehow break the causal connection. But the court still has a requirement to look at the totality of the overall evidence. And it's certainly worthy of a fact finder could conclude that the two people that they claim made the decision were not those people. And so I don't believe that that is in fact directing a particular outcome, Judge, given the totality of the overall evidence.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. And you'll have 5 minutes of rebuttal. And counsel for respondent, would you please identify yourself and then you may proceed.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Sarah McGrain. I'm from the Fellhaber Law Firm and I represent Summit Orthopedics. May it please the court and counsel. There are several factual inaccuracies that should be corrected right away. As Judge Sleater noted, it is undisputed that Kim Quigley was not involved in the decision to deny Mr. Johanning privileges. The record is very clear on that. Plaintiff has no record evidence to suggest otherwise. They speculate, they conjecture, they say people must be lying. But if we look at Ms. Quigley's deposition, page 53, line 24 through page 54, line 14, Dr. Katia's deposition, page 11, line 20 through line 24, and page 12, line 19 through page 13, line 14, and Dr. Daly's deposition, page 9, line 16 through line 22. The record evidence is undisputed that Ms. Quigley was not involved. I'd also like to go back to a comment that Mr. Smith made, that Kim Quigley was, quote unquote, the top HR individual in the organization. That is also not in the record, and frankly, it's not accurate. In the record, you have evidence that Julie Garrison is the vice president of HR. There are emails with her. Stephanie Sechrist is the number two person below Ms. Garrison, and Ms. Quigley is below them. So again, false statement, no record support. There was also a suggestion that Ms. Quigley put the application on hold and claimed that there was no record evidence that anything else was happening. Again, not factually accurate. Ms. Quigley testified in her deposition that they were waiting on Mr. Johanning's driver's license. And once that driver's license came through, they would then send it on to credentialing. That happened on December 3rd. According to her testimony, the credentialing committee didn't have it at that point. So again, inaccurate information. The other piece that I'd like to go back to is the suggestion by plaintiff's counsel that folks are lying. If we look at the plaintiff's brief, page 14, and I'm quoting, they say, it is not brazen to infer that Quigley and the credentialing doctors are lying. This is not conjecture. And again, there's no quotation. And it's important to note that that argument appears in their direct evidence section. So now they're saying that we speculate that people are lying, and that's direct evidence of discrimination. That is so far from the law, it's hard to even explain the levels that you have to go to get to that argument. We're also troubled that plaintiffs in their reply brief baldly misstated the law that's to be applied here. Plaintiff argued both in their opening brief and in their reply brief that the standard is whether or not something quote unquote played a role. That is not the law. And in fact, they cited the LaPointe case as evidence that it is. They have cited on page 4 of their reply brief, to prevail at trial, Johanning will only need to prove to a jury that his disability, more likely than not, played a role in Summit's decision to renew. He says that. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Excuse me, counsel. Let's focus on the question of the showing that's necessary for a disability and particularly the regarded as claim. Can you tell me your view of what the law requires to establish a regarded as claim?
Yes, Your Honor. The plaintiff there has to show several things. First, he has to show that he has an impairment, not just a diagnosis, that is materially limiting a major life activity. And Your Honor asked the question of where is the testimony on what is that limitation to a major life activity? And there isn't one. The judge properly cited in her opinion at pages 11 and 12, the testimony from Mr. Johanning's deposition where he was asked those questions. The only limitations that he testified to were social limitations and family limitations. And as the district court held, that is not enough. Secondly, plaintiffs have argued in their reply brief that we now have to look at his limitation in brain functioning by citing a CFR that actually supports the federal ADA. Again, even if we did apply that law, which we don't believe is proper, this is strictly an MHRA claim, we still don't have any testimony from Mr. Johanning that he is materially limited in his brain functioning. Mr. Johanning gave a deposition and he also submitted a declaration in opposition to summary judgment, and he never once made that argument. There is no record evidence of any material limitation.
So just following up, I'm maybe not characterizing this correctly, but my understanding of Mr. Smith's argument is that Mr. Johanning's testimony that the offer was rescinded due to his alcoholism is enough to show that the Summit regarded Mr. Johanning as having an impairment that limited his ability to work. Is that sufficient to demonstrate a regarded as claim?
No, it's not.
If we view Mr. Johanning's testimony as saying that, excuse me.
Yes, Your Honor. And on summary judgment, we had to accept the allegations of Mr. Johanning regarding that conversation, which the district court did. And the district court properly held that statement was not made by a decision maker. And because the conversation that Mr. Johanning allegedly had with Ms. Quigley was outside of the decisional process, and Ms. Quigley was not involved in any way in granting or denying privileges, which is the reason that he was, in fact, the offer was rescinded, the district court properly held that was not enough. That does not show evidence of regarded as. And again, we have to look at who is the person who's making the alleged comment and what is their role in that decisional process. And plaintiff has argued in their brief that Ms. Quigley must have had some role because she's in HR. But again, the undisputed record evidence is, other than vetting candidates by looking at resumes and again, passing along Mr. Johanning's resume as meeting qualifications, she had no role. She didn't interview him. She wasn't involved in reviewing the credentialing application. She didn't even speak with Drs. Katie and Dr. Daly about what they thought about his application. Instead, she simply communicated the decision. The case law on regarded as also talks about, do we view that person as precluded from performing a broad class of jobs? And here the record evidence is just the opposite. Not only did Summit not regard him as unable to perform a broad class of jobs, but they gave him an offer for an orthopedic position, which he declined.
Is there a question there though, as to that piece? I think they argue that there's some testimony that suggested that he might have required a background check before he would actually, they made him an offer, but it was a contingent offer, is my recollection of the argument they were making.
It's undisputed in the record, Your Honor, that there was no requirement that Mr. Johanning go through the credentialing process in order to move forward with the orthopedic position. He was given the offer. The only thing that would happen is a background check. And again, here, he passed the background check for the float position. What he didn't pass is the credentialing piece. So there is no record testimony that his orthopedic position was in any way in jeopardy. In fact, he's the one who declined the position. And then we get a step further. After he declines the position, Summit affirmatively reaches out to him and asks him to apply for the float pool position. So not only do we not preclude him or view him as unable to perform a broad class of jobs, but Summit offers him one job and invites him to apply for a second job. This is not a regarded as case, Your Honor, because plaintiff has not shown the record evidence that he needs to. It's also—
Also, did the district court err in determining that he wasn't qualified, assuming he can establish that the material issue of fact as to whether he's disabled? Did the district court err in determining that he's not qualified? I think the district court failed to consider the Hoover case. Are you familiar with that case? It's Hoover versus Northwest Private Mortgage.
Yes.
In that case, that was a discriminatory discharge case under the Minnesota Human Rights Act. And in that case, our Supreme Court specifically said, for purposes of establishing whether an individual is qualified for the position from which she was dismissed, the individual need only establish that she met the minimum objective qualifications of the job. Here, the district court focused on hospital privileges and concluded that Mr. Johanning was not qualified because he didn't have hospital privileges. But that determination, the record shows, is a subjective determination, not an objective determination. So given that, did the district court err in not applying the Hoover standard?
No, Your Honor. And in fact, I would disagree that the record evidence shows that the credentialing process is subjective, not objective. In fact, the testimony in the record from Drs. Kitty and Dr. Daly is that part of the credentialing process is subjective and part of the process is objective. And one of the pieces that's objective is Mr. Johanning answers a questionnaire that asks the question, have you been convicted of any criminal offenses? And he checked.
Is there an automatic disqualification for a criminal DUI conviction?
Yeah, the employer is not allowed to have an automatic disqualification under the EEOC guidance, but what they are allowed to do is look at what is that conviction for, how recent is the conviction, and how might it apply to the job. And the
does the record show any clear criteria that automatically, or not automatically, but that, I mean, it seems to me, it's not clear to me. I mean, obviously, whether he's convicted is an objective fact, but the decision is subjective given that they consider a variety of factors. I'm not understanding how it can be considered objective given that there's a variety of factors that play into the decision.
It's undisputed, Your Honor, that he admitted the convictions, he disclosed the convictions, and the physicians testified that when we hire a physician's assistant, a PA, they testify under the provider, under the doctor's license. And so they're acting as we are acting. So those physicians who are involved in the credentialing, who at the time were the former chief of the medical staff and the new chief of the medical staff, looked at his application and looked at the three criminal convictions, which he acknowledged, including the recency, one of which was only a matter of months old. It wasn't even a year old. And they determined that based upon those convictions, they did not believe that he was qualified to do the float PA role. That is the undisputed evidence.
Okay, well, but let's go back to the Hoover language, because I think you're still missing the point of the Hoover language. That's an important point of that, which is a plaintiff need only establish that she met the minimum objective qualifications for the job. And I believe there's testimony from Summit orthopedic employees that were involved in the hiring process that Mr. Johanning met the education and experience qualifications for the job. And indeed, that's why Summit reached out to him. So given that standard, didn't the district court err in concluding that he wasn't qualified in that he met the minimum objective qualifications for the job?
No, Your Honor. The undisputed testimony in the record from Chad Nelson, which is listed in the addendum at page 15 of the district court's decision, is that the float PA role has to go through the credentialing process and receive privileges because of the high number of surgeries that they perform in that role, which is over 50%. So the undisputed record evidence from the person who is the director of the PAs was that having credentialing and privileging was a job requirement. So no, he did not meet the minimum qualifications.
Agree with you that hospital privileges are objective.
Even if they're subjective, Your Honor, there's nothing
but the language says objective qualifications, not subjective. That's where I'm struggling.
Right. But credentials is objective. You have to be credentialed. That is an objective standard. The process by which you do anything is going to involve some element of subjectivity. And courts have never said that just because there's an element of subjectivity in assessing qualifications, that somehow it's ruled out or it can't be. The record evidence is very clear that credentialing is required to do the float PA role. That is the role that he was being considered for, and that is the role that the two providers who reviewed his application said he was not qualified to do. And for those reasons, Summit Orthopedics respectfully requests that this court affirm the district court's dismissal. And again, the district court erred in Summit's favor on probably eight different ways that could require affirmance. So even if the court would rule against us on the objective qualifications, which again, I think is wrong, but if you did, there are numerous other bases to affirm, and we'd respectfully request that you do. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. McGrain. And Mr. Smith, you will now have 5 minutes of rebuttal. And as soon as you see the clock, there it is. You may proceed.
All right. Thank you, Your Honor. Counsel just said that it's undisputed that Quigley was not involved. And again, I think this is the key fact for a jury to decide credibility on. This is what the exchange was when she rescinded the job offer or put the pause on the job offer. Quote, is this because I was in treatment for alcoholism? Are they rescinding because of that? Quigley says yes. Are they rescinding? That's the organization. He's asking, is the organization rescinding this because of the recency of your treatment? It was just too recent. That a reasonable fact finder could conclude that Quigley is speaking on behalf of either herself as a high level HR person or on behalf of the organization in rescinding it. And so the idea that we can isolate Quigley as a matter of law from this process, no, a fact finder could conclude that they means the organization, that Quigley talked to these folks. Counsel just said Quigley didn't put it on hold immediately. Jim Johannig testified. She put it on hold immediately. She did that on her own. We need to stop this process. So the fact that Quigley says that didn't happen, that's fine. A jury could maybe conclude that she's telling the truth, but that's not what Jim Johannig said. A couple of other brief points. There was some talk about the motivating factor played a part. I unfortunately know way more about that than I want to because I was counsel on LaPointe. And so I just asked the court to read LaPointe, Anderson, Hunter, Keith, all the cases that talk about what the standard is. Defendants always try to argue it's but for or some very high standard. It's motivating factor played a part. That's what it is. LaPointe put the stake in that for good. What that means is could a reasonable fact finder conclude that discrimination was a substantial motivating factor or played some role in the decision to not offer him the job in this case or rescind the job in this case? And a fact finder could conclude that it did. It doesn't need to be the only reason. He doesn't need to show it was the only reason. But if he can show that it was a motivating factor or played some role consistent with a couple decades of Minnesota Supreme Court case law on that, a jury could conclude as much. So, counsel,
I'd like to turn back to the regarded as claim for a minute. And I believe I misspoke earlier. I think you're correct that the whether Summit regarded him as limited by an impairment, I think whether that limitation applied to a broad class of jobs that is considered in the disability determination, not the qualified piece. So I misspoke there. But I do think the case law still requires a showing that the individual is regarded as disabled in having, or let me rephrase that. And I'll quote from a federal case, the Minnesota Human Rights Act defines an individual regarded as disabled as one who others regard as having an impairment which materially limits one or more major life activities. So, and when you look at the definition of disabled, is regarded as having such an impairment. So I think there still needs to be a showing, unless that ADA language is read in, that the employer regards the individual as being materially limited in one or more major life activities. So I'd like to turn back to that. I mean, you get to the broad class of jobs secondarily, but first you examine whether there's evidence that the employer regarded the individual as having an impairment that materially limits one or more major life activities. So again, what evidence is there in the record that Summit regarded Johanning as being materially limited in one or more major life activities?
Well, the statement itself seems to suggest that they viewed him as limited in working. Because when you say, is it the recency of the alcohol treatment or it's just too recent? Yes. And as I said before, perhaps inartfully, a reasonable way of interpreting that statement is, go have your relapse somewhere else. It's just too recent. We're concerned that it's going to happen again. And so they think he's limited in his ability to work because he just came out of Hazelden. And so I don't think sometimes we have to make an argument that is a little bit of a stretch. That's not it here. They certainly, that's the way that they appear to have viewed him as limited in broad class of working.
Thank you.
If you want to wrap up, I know you're answering Judge Cochran's question. If you have a final summary, you may do so.
Sure. Thank you. So given the timeline, December 3rd, they have no issue with his application. We don't need to show that every person viewed him as limited in a class of jobs or was concerned, just some decision makers, and quickly informs him that he needs a worksite monitor. He is, they put it on pause, and then days later they rescind his offer of employment. There's certainly enough under the totality of circumstances and what courts sometimes refer to as a convincing mosaic of evidence to show for a fact finder to conclude that discrimination was the motivating factor or played some role in this. And we respectfully request this court remand for a trial on those issues. Thank you.
Thank you to both counsel. We appreciate your briefing for us and to us and your answers to our questions. We will now take the matter under advisement, issue an order within the 90-day time period, and we will now adjourn on this matter. You each have a good day.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.